Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is Zach Kaplan, who is returning today, not to talk about Port of Earth, which I would love to get into later, but his other series, Eclipse, a groundbreaking environmental disaster mystery. Does that about cover it?
Yeah. There's a lot of genre thrown in there. I always lose myself in the little post-apocalyptic, a little dystopian, a little thriller, a little action, mystery, and at the core of it all is the environmental disaster. So absolutely.
So there's a lot there for everyone to love. And correct me if I'm wrong, didn't this get looked at by Sci-Fi Channel for an adaptation?
Well, it's been picked up by Robert Kirkman, who is, of course, the creator of Walking Dead. And mm-hmm. So they've been working to develop it into a TV show, but it has yet to, they've still got it in the laboratory. So it has yet to find a home with any particular network. So perhaps sci-fi, perhaps something else. But yeah, that was the exciting news of it all.
So basically, it's still in a development petri dish with people poking at it, trying to figure out how to make it work.
That's right.
Well, Eclipse fascinated me because the underlying premise is most of the world has literally burned because of unknown activity from the sun. The sun, daylight is now fatal.
Yes.
And everyone has to live underground, but you have these people who have to go above ground in daylight to fix the services that keep people alive underground, the water, the electricity, the basic necessities, even though life underground isn't anywhere close to what it was above ground, people are still surviving and trying to get by. Now, this story starts, this mystery starts, is it 10 years after the original flare?
Okay. Yes. There's the flare is the term they've given for this solar apocalyptic event that has caused all this chaos. And rather than start the story immediately after, we start the story 10 years after, with a society that has found a way to survive. So just as you described it.
I want to make sure I have this right. The flare was described as 24 different flares, each one with some ridiculous amount of energy.
I think at one point he tries to sum up how equated to the level of energy that was unleashed, but it was massive. And I remember doing a lot of research, and the sun has always surprised us with all sorts of interesting phenomenon. I think there is a history even of solar flares that have been so large that they hit the earth and actually wiped out our, I think there was one back in the 1800s that wiped out our primitive electric grid. And they've cooked up all sorts of scenarios for how we might deal with this. Now, this takes it one step further and says that in the aftermath of whatever has happened, that the sun has changed on us. And it is a bit of a mystery as to what has happened and why. But it has left sunlight, once this very nurturing, life-giving force that we all kind of think about it as a positive thing, to be a deadly negative in the daily life. And of course, whenever I'm talking about this project, it's something that is fascinating because I think 50 years ago, we all thought of the sun as just a happy thing. But now, with the extreme nature of the sun, you know, we put on sunscreen constantly. The sun is contributing to heat waves and skin cancer and all sorts of things. So there's now this antagonistic relationship that we have with the sun. So it there's something about the concept that feeds into just our psyche of how we currently feel about the sun nowadays and on our environment. So mm-hmm.
So I remember back in the 80s, there was some concern about whether our atmosphere would actually survive if the ozone layer got too thin. It wouldn't be able to block enough of the radiation, and we would cook, or too much of our breathable atmosphere would burn off. And then in the 90s, I was doing like IT work, and for about 4 to 6 weeks, we had, shall we say, spotty communications because of high sunspot activity. That's what they said.
There you go.
And we kept, like, phone lines kept failing, and I was working for a company. This is early internet, so all of our internet connections were dial up, baby. And modems kept getting fried. Literally, modems kept getting fried. And I was in there swapping out new modems twice a week, it seemed like, for about, you know, almost 2 months. And they attributed it to sunspot activity.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fascinating beast, the sun. And it's really interesting to think about how it could go haywire on us. And so that was, you know, that was where kind of a lot of my research stemmed in this concept. And it, you know, I found it less important to talk about the, exactly how it happened. I remember talking to some scientists, and rather than get bogged down in the nuance of it all, I found it more interesting to talk about okay, the sun has turned deadly. So what does that evoke? What kind of experience? What kind of primitive aspect does that bring us to? And you know, to go from there. And so that was the world that I set out to explore in Eclipse: a deadly sun and how we survive.
The aftermath.
The aftermath.
So what sort of research did you do in order to build this world? Because I have to tell you, the artwork, who's your artist? Gio Timpano?
Giovanni Timpano, yeah. And yeah. He's amazing. And we, this was his first creator-owned book, and we really hit it off in terms of our love of world building and geeking out over every little detail. I came in. I mean, I think I was lucky to team up with him, because many other artists would have not been as interested in this level of detail and world building, but he loved it. He wants to be the next Jeff Darrow in terms of artistic detail. And so we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, the air conditioners and the buildings. And so we decided that no one was really living up beyond the first or second floor of a building inside. They couldn't go much higher. And that when we see air conditioners, we would see them all kind of just above the shop level. And we talked about the wires and how that would work, and the doors on the subway entrances and exits, and how they would open and close, and just you know, the lighting, and then the billboards coming up with different advertisements for nighttime beaches or underground farms, and all just the nuance. And we constantly, every time he had a real love for these very epic landscapes and these splash pages. And so we would do more and more of them and constantly try to drop in more detail and more world. It was born more out of our imagination and talking everything out and trying to find the best way to portray the world. But yeah, we had a blast doing it, and it's gorgeous artwork. I'm so proud of it.
Yeah, because the detail in the artwork throughout the entire book is so rich but contrasted, because you have everything above ground looks weather-worn. You could tell that the heat of the sun, the radiation, whatever is killing people has eaten away at the buildings, has eaten away at the streets, has eaten away at the abandoned above-ground spaces, the abandoned cars, the abandoned trucks, the abandoned factories. And even in scenes where the sun is out, there's this almost snow glare effect over the entire scene. You can tell how powerful that light is, because everything is just hazy and it's almost too bright. You even some of the drawings, it looks like you feel like you want to squint.
Yeah. I mean, he's got all these amazing details from every window that shattered and the weathered nature. And he even has talked about how he changed his style because he came from doing The Shadow and I think he did Lone Ranger and a lot of stuff that was a little heavier on the shadowing and on his lines, and he thinned out his lines so that the above ground world of Eclipse would feel real arid and kind of worn, as you say. And then we worked a lot with the colorist. We started with a colorist, Chris Northrup, and then after the first arc, we switched to Flavio Dispenza. But coloring was so instrumental in making sure that above ground palette was really, really, you know, just yellows and tans, and everything felt just completely saturated by sunlight, and there was no color anywhere. You couldn't, and all the color was completely baked out. And then you'd go underground, and it was a completely different world. All, you know, it was more color, more lighting, but also desaturated and very, very kind of cynical look down there as well. And so we had a lot of collaboration in finding the palettes, finding the right approach for the artwork and talking all about the details. I mean, even the suit design, we talked about, so in the story, that when they go above ground, they're wearing these, they call them Iceman suits, and they're using some form of liquid nitrogen to cool these suits for a limited period of time and keep the user completely encapsulated. And in designing those suits, you know, we said, well, they should feel almost like an astronaut suit, so that it evokes this feeling that the person is going out into an alien atmosphere, and they should be heavy and bulky and more protective and not cool. They should be kind of cumbersome and really make you feel like these like our hero is walking on the moon when he goes out into a street. So yeah, it was there was a lot of world building, and it was a blast. It was, yeah.
Well, the story itself covers not only the mystery of what happened, but we're introduced to a corruption revenge plot by someone who's immune to the sun. How's that?
Yeah. That's right.
Now, the layering of the different elements of the story combines with just the unusual nature that we're really not going to get the whole story by story's end. Now, this series, no pun intended, eclipses 16 issues broken down into four chapters. So we've got four trade paperback collections, four arcs that are in the story. And the appeal of a limited story, It attracted me more than I thought it would. I, you know, as I grew up collecting comics in the 80s and 90s, and you looked forward to those new issues every week. But after you fall away for a while, those are harder to get back into. And you're looking at, even with the popularity of the Marvel movies and the DC movies, you're like, okay, I like the story that the movie's following. I kind of want to get back into it. And then you get into arguments with people online about where to jump in, because there's no good on-ramp to those long-established series. So stories like this and other stories that follow in the path that Watchmen and V for Vendetta and Dark Knight Returns sort of started off with, the limited series, I find those more and more appealing as I get, you know, more picky about which comics I spend time with. And I think there has to be a little bit of flexibility, a little bit of freedom that you as a creator get from focusing on a story that you know has a beginning and an end, and it's not going to take 15 years to get there.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, there's a lot of layers there. I mean, I completely agree, and it was always enjoyable, because I think knowing that you have an ending allows you to to speed up the character evolution. I mean, this is ultimately a story, despite having this amazing fun hook and a high concept idea and a lot of world and some great art. It's a character story. It's a story about these people, and we follow a few characters in specificity in this, in the city of New York that survived and their experience. And so I always wanted to tell a story about how these characters evolve and change over this experience. And, you know, we set out to make a very fast paced story so that it would be a real page turner from the beginning to the end. But we tried also to spend these slow moments with these characters, and I think each arc you're seeing them respond to what's happened. And so it becomes very intoxicating to say, okay, well, I just saw this one experience happen, and now in the next arc, how are they going to affect and change by that experience? And where is this leading them? And you kind of want to know what's going to happen to those characters, and where are they going to end up, and how's this all going to play out? And yeah, it's a lot more fulfilling to be able to get that closure after, you know, just 16 issues, which is in and of itself we're not talking about a mini series. It's not just a standalone 5-issue or a, you know, 8-issue. This is it is an ongoing, and it does span a bit, but it's certainly not going into the 30s, 40s, or 50s. You get that closure. And some of the best compliments I had were having fans come up to me at conventions and say, you know, it's so fast and I want more. And I'd say, well, no, we're trying to keep it contained and deliver something that will be very fulfilling in the end. So, when I said I was going to end it, they were like, why are you ending it? And I was like, it's time for it to end. It's the story's ready for it. But, yeah, we had a ton of, freedom. And the publisher, Top Cow, was the imprint in Image Comics. They gave us a tremendous amount of freedom from the get-go to tell the story we wanted to tell. And so, and when the fans responded, that gave us more freedom to kind of to do the way we wanted. So it was a lot of fun. I guess this is called a maxi series, but it's, you know, something that ends, you know, after a few arcs. So, yeah, mm-hmm. it was very fulfilling.
Now, as a creator-owned title, did you actually pitch this as 16 issues, or did you pitch this as a limited series and you would figure out where the end would be as you went along?
The truth is that I don't think you ever really know. And this was my first comic. This was my breakout. And so I had pitched many other ideas for years, and I pitched this. And I had mapped out how I saw the first arc playing out, and I had ideas about where it would go, and I ultimately knew where I wanted it to end. But, you know, I had no idea that I was going to even get to do more than 4 or 5, you know, and initially when it was greenlit, that was what I was given. And I think that creators are put in this very awkward situation, especially when you're starting out of, you know, do you just close it up or do you leave room for more? And I took the gamble because it was a story that I really thought had a lot of legs and room. And so I kind of left it more open-ended. And I also was able to make that decision based on the way that comics are produced, because by the time issue 1 was being ordered, we had not completed issue 4. And so when I started to hear that issue 1 was being very well received in terms of interest and orders and early reviews, I was able to kind of go, okay, I'm gonna leave issue four a little even more open than I, you know, had initially hoped. And then when issue 1 came out, we were given the opportunity to switch to an ongoing. And then, ironically enough, I faced the same decision at every arc. You know, I was given by issue 1, we were told we could be ongoing, but I wasn't sure if I was going to get to go past issue 8. And so going into the second arc, I had to make the same choice. And I took that gamble that, okay, I'm going to leave it. I'm going to leave this really open ended here and hope that I get that third arc. And then I got, you know, then we got to continue, and I made the same choice And it was right around then I kind of said, okay, I see this story being able to play out in 16 issues, and that's what I'm shooting for, and I'm going for it. And we were able to go all the way. But it's a challenge. I mean, it's no different. I think a lot of TV shows face the same thing. This idea of you could get canceled at any time, and you know, the fans are always, but what happens? You left that guy, you know, in the middle of nowhere, and now the show's over, and that happens sometimes. So, but yeah, with Eclipse, we kind of were ride and die by our cliffhangers at the end of every arc, and we were just kind of hoping that we'd get to tell more, and we managed to take it all the way.
Now, what can you tell us about the story development? Because if I remember correctly, the first arc came out in 2016, and then there was a long break after the second arc before you came back with the third arc this year, right?
That's right, yeah. That was actually just purely because the publisher was taking a beat to determine where we were going to go with the third arc. And in that break, which was supposed to be 2 or 3 months, Giovanni got the opportunity. He got approached by Dynamite Entertainment about doing a crossover with DC Comics for Batman Shadow. And, you know, artists dream of the opportunity to draw Batman as a published character. And so he kind of came to me and said, look, this is a kind of a dream of mine. I'm going to get to draw Batman. You know, I know we're about to do more. And I said, look, go draw Batman, and then we'll just take a break and we'll come back. And, you know, I actually, when I first wanted Giovanni, we approached him and he was not available for 5 months, and I could have gone with another artist, but I was like, let's go for it. And I think that was, Eclipse was announced, and then we waited for Giovanni, and then he came on. So so Eclipse has been a real, there's been a lot of waiting on my, and for to bring Eclipse and bring more Eclipse, but I couldn't see doing it with another artist, and I wasn't about to make him choose. And so I said, go do it, and we'll come back. And so that led to almost, I think, a year break between the end of the second arc and the beginning of the third arc. And then we came back kind of with a vengeance, and I had really had time to work out the final 8 issues, and so that was that was the nature of that break. So yeah, it did span from about the end of September of 2016 was when issue 1 came out, and then we just wrapped it at this year.
So during that whole entire creative process, what did you learn about creating your own story? Because like you said, this was your first creator-owned comic. This was the first one that got published anyway. And since then you've done Port of Earth and what's the other one?
Lost City Explorers is a young adult adventure with Aftershock Comics. And those are the 3 that have been published. I've got a bunch more in the works for next year, but God, what did I learn? I mean, where to begin? I mean, first and foremost, I came from a story background. So, you know, I went to USC's film school to study film and TV writing. And I spent many years in Hollywood pursuing film and TV stuff and never got anything on screen. But I wrote a lot of specs and a lot of scripts and spent a lot of time studying stories. So, I understood story. I had grown up reading comics. My whole life I'd wanted to do one. But I don't think I really understood the craft of comic book writing. And Eclipse was definitely a crash course. And, you know, I think the biggest thing that I learned and I'm still learning is pacing. I think that is really, you know, there's so many things to do well when you're telling a story. But I think that finding when to speed up a moment, when to slow down a moment in comics, because comics is a medium of space and how much space you have on the page and how much space you give to a moment. And that was for me, the constant questions that I faced, you know, all the logistics and plotting and stuff that comes over time as you just hash out a story. But trying to decide when to give a character a real moment to breathe and how to try to create those emotional moments. And I think having faith that the readers do want those slow moments, that it's okay to spend, you know, when you're writing an action adventure or thriller story, it's very easy to kind of to lean on that aspect of the genre and think that that's going to be what turns the page. And it's not, you know, it's the creating really complex characters that are flawed and torn and facing really hardship and drama, and then really turning the screws to them and watching them suffer and tapping into their emotions and trying to, that was what I, you know, found the most faith in more and more. And I think that's what I took with me, is that don't lose the heart and the emotion of a story just because it's being drawn and just because it's about a medium where you're always trying to end the page with a cliffhanger and always trying to end the series with a cliffhanger. And you're always trying to find ways to surprise the reader. But the readers are in your story because they care about the characters. And so that, you know, David Baxter, the hero of the story, and the girl that's initially targeted by this killer CLO, and her father, Nick, and these characters that we're following to make them three-dimensional, nuanced characters that people really care about. That was what I took away from it. And hopefully I did a good job.
I'd say pretty good, based on the, like, what I read and what people have been saying about the series in general. You definitely reached a few people who have questions, and then of course you have the story addicts who want just a little bit more.
Yeah.
What for you was more, I guess, fulfilling as a story creator, to design the mystery and the hidden side of what these characters would uncover, or the trials and tribulations that the characters themselves would actually go through?
Oh, I think it's the trials and tribulations that the characters go through. And I think that people who read Eclipse, some of the compliments that I get is how complex and nuanced it is. And I don't think it's, you'll see a character and you'll think that this character is black and white and that this decision is easy. And then you realize that, oh no. I mean, one of my favorite characters to write in the story was Nick Brandt, who's the kind of, he's not the mayor of this town. He's kind of a solar tycoon, and he's kind of taken control of this town by his taking control of the city's solar power. And he starts off as this very clearly two-dimensional, corrupt business guy who's going to do whatever it takes to maintain power. And what was fun was to pull the layers back of that and to see, well, the reason that he's done this is because he's faced lots of adversaries that wanted to destroy the society and take even more control, and that he's actually a pragmatist, and that actually the reason he created this society in this way in the beginning was to protect his family and the people he cared about and his community, and then his relationship with his daughter, that you think, well, he's a horrible father, but then he's actually tried to teach her how to survive and how to live, and he's never been perfect. But just to constantly play with those human layers, and I just find that nobody is evil and nobody is bad, and it's always interesting to look at the nuance of all that. Cielo was another character I really loved writing. I mean, this girl that starts off as this real kind of spoiled rich party girl, and she's a little clueless. I always thought of her as kind of the princess in the castle who doesn't really know what's really going on the streets. And you know, this killer comes after her, and it kind of opens her eyes and makes her realize, well, what is really going on in this city, and how sheltered she's been, and how she's not really been exposed to the hardships that people have faced, and it kind of changes her, and she doesn't want to be a party girl anymore, and she doesn't want to focus on her clothes and on her good times. She wants to find out what's going on and be a part of the solution. She turns into a rebel of sorts, and certainly a truth finder, and a very empowered young woman. And the story is very much hers throughout the whole series. And you don't kind of get that she's going to be so instrumental. And you know, one of the best compliments I got when we went to the second arc was that people loved seeing more of her character. The story starts off with these, every issue has these flashbacks where we see a bit of the character's life before the flare, or certainly before this moment in the present. And that those flashbacks kind of inform who they are and the reason the way they are and what they're really facing, why the current dilemma is all that much more complex for them. And, you know, I had a lot of fun writing those scenes, those flashbacks, whether it was Cielo and her father, or Bax's flashbacks, and just kind of informing. Bax has lost his family, and it really informs why he is the way he is and why he's making the decisions he's making. And I think that, you know, it's a story. The theme of the story was so much more important to me, as much fun as the world. It's like, I don't know. I know D&D is very big right now. It's like, once you set the stage of the world, it's the journey that's really the most entertaining. And so to me, to take these characters through the world and test them and tell this story about survival and optimism in the face of such tragedy, that was really what was the most enjoyable to me.
Yeah, I really liked how you set up, what's his name, Brandt. He looked like, you know, he's half mayor, half CEO.
Yeah.
He's this really super powerful guy. He's, I guess, he's like on the board or head of the board of the company that runs the solar panels, generating the electricity for everybody underground. You have his daughter named Rose, but she calls herself Cielo. She's a party girl. She wants, typical rebellious, teen young woman who's, you know, the rich spoiled girl who's rebelling against daddy because, you know, reasons. And then you've got Baxter, who is the emotionally closed off, aloof sort of fixer.
Yeah.
And then you have all the, like, you know, from D&D, okay, here are your character sheets. I'm going to play to your trope expectations, and we're going to throw these all out.
Yeah. They all change in really, really, really powerful, fast ways. I mean, Bax was so interesting because after he starts off close and completely disconnected, he doesn't want any part of anything that's going on in the city. And so after the first arc, he says, okay, well, maybe I should be more connected. And what's ironic is when I thought about, well, where does that send him, is it actually sends him right to working for the bad guys because they're the ones in control of the city. So when you have this dystopian city and someone says, well, I want to help, let me help the police, let me help Solidarity. Well, now you're just a cog in the wheel. So you went from being this disconnected influence to just a foot soldier who's going to do what they want you to do. And so it creates all sorts of complexity there in terms of, well, what do you do then? What do you do when you're faced with choices where you can't win because you're still supporting an institution that is inherently flawed? I mean, that's his ultimate arc, is to kind of realize that the only way for him to truly make a change and change himself is to stand up for his ideals and really try to take full responsibility for this city as opposed to just partial responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I just had, you know, and that it and finding a way to tell that those kinds of character stories and then relate it to the theme of this this solar cataclysmic tragedy, which to me is also a metaphor for what's happening to our planet or a metaphor for any tragedy ever, which is, you know, it's very disheartening when these things happen. And it's very easy to just keep your head down and look out for yourself and stay disconnected and be smart. And that doesn't actually end up helping the situation sometimes. Sometimes you have to live or die by your values and principles. So, it was trying to connect everything, connect this story about a deadly sun and say, well, this is not just a cool hook. This is about something more relevant, more interesting, more dynamic, more complex, more heartfelt. So I was going, and then I don't know what talking about how excited I am about all these elements. So,
well, the fact that you're excited about them shows how invested you are, how passionate you were about telling this story. And that's reflected in how the readers are reacting to the story. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, of course it is. Of course, you have to be passionate about these stories. I mean, also, you can see this story from the time I pitched it in 2015 to the time it comes out. This is a 4-year odyssey to put 16 issues together. And you know, from every conversation about every detail to every, you know, moment of cracking the story or trying to connect all these things together, these are a tremendous amount of work. At least for me, they are. I don't know how to do these to not be passionate about something like this and to not really try to put my heart and soul and say something about it. So that was what, you know, what was really important. I opened the first volume with a letter about, you know, many years ago. I was a poker dealer, and, you know, just it was so funny because you'll enjoy this. The listeners will enjoy this. I mean, a lot of this seeped into the story. I was a poker dealer, so I was working a graveyard shift. So I was going to work when everybody else was coming home. So I was a passing ship. I was disconnected from everybody. And then I would wake up and I would drive home at sunrise, which was really kind of where the idea came from, driving home at sunrise with just the sun out and empty streets and no one's out. And that was kind of where the concept of sunlight dominating us and everyone hiding inside came from. But more so, what seeped into it is the protagonist is working a graveyard shift. And when he's going home, everyone's going out. He's a passing ship too, and he feels very cut off and isolated. And these are all feelings and emotions that I was feeling at this time. And, you know, I live my life no matter what happens, how important it is to stay optimistic and positive, because otherwise you'll never get out of whatever you're facing. That's the most important thing to me. And so, you know, that was even going through a period where I felt very cut off and disconnected and trying to stay optimistic, and then bringing all of that into this story. I think that's, you know, there was something personal for me about the importance of optimism in the face of feeling disconnected, in the face of tragedy, in the face of not being content with everything and the importance of all that. So even if the sun turns deadly, you have to find an appreciation for something. You can't just say, well, let's just hide underground.
Cool. Well, how much of what you learned in the collaboration process, in the story crafting process, did you apply to Port of Earth? Because when we talked last year, yeah, Port of Earth had just come out and completely blew my mind, literally blew my mind. And it's still continuing and still continuing to entertain and surprise. What, for me, Port of Earth seems like a tighter, more tense story. Now, is that something that you learned while writing Eclipse, and you just applied that to Port of Earth? How did that evolution happen?
I don't know. I guess, you know, it's just second grade for me. You know, I learned what I took from first grade and learned how to do math a little faster. I don't know. I think I became more comfortable. I imagine if you read Eclipse, people will find each arc tighter than the last. Mm-hmm. And I think that Port of Earth, I just got more comfortable with each of the elements. I think that's still happening. I feel more comfortable when I write new scripts now than before. But I think Port of Earth, I had, just more confidence in everything. Port of Earth was interesting for me because it was, and I don't know if we've talked about this before, but I took a real chance on the style in which I told that kind of very detached, seeing everything through interview, through camera, and making the reader really feel like they were disconnected and unable to really, like they're all watching the whole thing unfold on the news. Again, it's tremendous amount of world building, but then at the core, and you start out with these very two-dimensional characters who then are not two-dimensional at all, who then flip and actually have some real tough dilemmas to face in the world. And in a large part, they're very powerless in the world. So I feel like when people look back on my stuff, they're going to see a lot of similar themes and elements. But I guess by the time I got to Port of Earth, I was a little more comfortable with the medium and a little more confident in having 8 issues to do this first arc, and then leaving it open to do another 8 issues and to continue it. But yeah, I don't know. It's hard to figure out what I learned in terms of the nuts and bolts of comic book writing. But I think it's just a confidence in letting the moments breathe and how to structure a good comic in 20 pages.
Do you know yet where you're going with Port of Earth? Like how long it's going to be total?
Oh yes. I mean, I have very big plans. I would like to definitely go into the 20s with Port of Earth. We're already at 12, and I could easily, we've got 4 more issues for the rest of this particular arc. I see the Port of Earth is kind of divided into seasons, almost 8 issue seasons. And so 1 through 8 kind of stand alone as a first season. And then 9 through 16 is the next. But I could easily do a couple more of it. It's different for me than Eclipse, because Eclipse was a story about the characters, and the world, that city, wasn't really changing. And so you really just were telling a story about those characters. Port of Earth, the world is changing. There's an escalation that you feel. We made this deal, and it wasn't a good deal. For those of you who don't know, Port of Earth is aliens have come to Earth not in war, peace, but with a business deal. So we make a business deal with them. We get some cool technology. And we allow them to set up a port here on Earth, and alien travelers start coming through, and it doesn't go according to plan. But that deal and the ramifications of that deal are constantly getting worse and worse and worse. And so not only are we following the characters, but we're following the story of the deal and our world in the aftermath of this deal, and that it's changing. And so because it's changing, it gives the story a lot more to explore. And so I would love to, I know exactly where it's going. I know the ending. Now, whether I'll do the ending in, 24 issues or 32 issues, time will tell. But I definitely know the ending, and it's just a question of how long or slow we have to get there. But it seems like it's been going real well. The third arc, third trade comes out in a couple weeks, and I'm very excited to let people who wait for graphic novels check that out.
Well, I will definitely encourage them to check it out because you cannot imagine the shenanigans that ensue when you let human and alien corporate lawyers broker interstellar, inter-extraterrestrial treaties and backroom deals.
That's right. But isn't it exactly how it will happen, Summer? If aliens were to come and say, we want to set up a port here, isn't this exactly what would happen? The government would hand over the contracts to the corporations, and the corporations would broker a deal, and you would have corporations and governments looked after, and the deal would be made, and we would all be in the dark. We wouldn't know what happened. I mean, this is what happens on a day-to-day basis. Take any other country. Why would making a deal with aliens is like making a deal with any other country. Why would it be any different? So that's the most fun about Port of Earth, is the aliens act just like humans, and the scenario is like any other scenario from throughout human history, either the past or most likely the future. It's just, you know, the best compliments I get are, this is what's going to happen, you know? And I'm like, yes, this is what's going to, and that was why it was such a fun idea to explore, because I remember watching another trailer on TV where aliens come to just eradicate humanity for, I don't know, the fun of it. And you're just kind of like, we've done this, okay, right? We've seen aliens come to Earth. And they either are pissed off and they're super technologically advanced and they blow us away, or they come and they look like Jodie Foster's dad and they enlighten us. And I'm like, but wait, what if they're like human and they come and they want a deal? Like, that, what would happen then? And it's just so much fun to explore. I love that world so much.
And I have no idea what's worse, the fact that these alien species have developed their own interstellar trade, and they actually have space law school for aliens.
Yeah.
Or that somehow they watched old reruns of LA Law and decided, hey, we can do that.
Yeah, it's all about the deal. It's all what's in the – I have a scene – I'll give a spoiler to people who are listening. One of the scenes that I'm going to write in a future Port of Earth issue is a room at the Earth Security Agency that has the deal, right? And the deal must be millions of pages of paper, right? And so I think it's like one of those rooms with like the claws that go along the walls, right? And you just see reams of paper because that's the deal. Like, you know, it's the thickest deal you could ever imagine. And when they say it's clause 10,022 section BFG whatever, it's all, you know, it's the alien galactic version of contracts. It would be the scariest thing in the world. How do you even keep up with it? I imagine that a human reading the deal for Port of Earth, it would take a lifetime to like read the deal or something. It's got to be like that. That's the alien galactic version of law, as you say.
Cool. Well, with Eclipse, you said volume four.
Volume 4 has come out. It came out a couple months ago, so you can go and collect all four of them, volumes 1 through 4.
Yep. Do you know if Top Cow has any plans to put out a collected compendium of all four volumes?
I keep telling them. I would love for them to do that. I'm hoping so. We shall see. If you're listening and you want it, tell Top Cow to do it. I would love to have them do it. I'm hoping they will eventually do it. I know they just did one for their title Postal. So hopefully they'll feel the need for more and they'll do this one. But I would love that one standalone. Yeah.
As someone who bought the huge, huge compendium of JMS's Rising Stars, you know, yes, the huge big book. Yes, people will buy those.
I think so too. Yeah, absolutely. I think people will buy them too, and they go great in bookstores too. I'm all for it. I'd buy one.
Well, what are you working on next, other than Portiverse?
It's the weird comic thing. It's all these secret comic stuff that you don't talk about until it's announced. But I have several new creator-owned titles. So it's kind of funny. I had Eclipse hit and Port of Earth, and I kind of fell into two ongoing series. And Lost the Explorers was a mini. And I kind of have spent a lot of the past year kind of doing more Port of Earth and wrapping Eclipse. But I've been able to put a lot of new irons in the fire. And so while they're all just getting, they're still not announced and they're just starting and being drawn and I'm just writing the beginnings of them all, it looks like I'll have a ton of new content hitting next year. So unfortunately, it's still too soon. I can't talk about any of it. But it's all I'll say is it's all sci-fi. That's my lane and that's where I'm spending all my time and finding yet new and interesting ways to explore sci-fi elements like alien arrivals or cataclysmic environmental catastrophes that have not, you know, finding new twists on that stuff. So I'm hoping, I think if people like Eclipse and Port of Earth, they'll be very excited about the new stuff. But it's all very new, so I can't really talk about it yet.
Okay. Well, we will have links to the Eclipse collections, the Port of Earth collection so far. Where can people find you online so they can, like I do, follow your Twitter feed and find out what's coming out when?
Yes, I'm on Twitter a lot, Zach Capps, ZACKKAPS, and that is also Facebook, Instagram, and then I have a website, ZachCapps.com, and you can find me all those places and say hi.
Awesome. Well, Zach, thank you for sharing this deep dive into cool independent sci-fi comic stories. Creator owned, by the way, and we will have links, like I said, to all of your locations and to where people can find Eclipse and Port of Earth. Is Port of Earth also under consideration for television adaptation?
Port of Earth is not only also with Robert Kirkman as a producer, but it is at Amazon Studios currently. The pilot is being written.
Cool.
Yes. So Port of Earth, despite coming out after Eclipse, has been on a bit of a fast track towards television. So I don't ever like to count chickens before they're hatched. But that one is already at Amazon TV for a TV show, and they're writing a pilot. So nice. If everybody is a fan of Port of Earth, cross some fingers. Perhaps it will be coming to you shortly. On the stream too. So
awesome. And considering that they picked up The Expanse, which I think we're getting season 4 in December. Yay.
Yes.
Yay.
Yes. And they've done a killer job with The Boys. So I'm very excited to have Amazon behind it.
Cool. Very. Well, once again, Zach, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Summer.
We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
A lonely alien pet bravely waits for the family that may never return. An astronaut with seconds to live discovers just how good victory can taste. A mecha pilot and an aristocrat strike up an unlikely friendship. Take a ride with Escape Pod, the Hugo-nominated weekly science fiction podcast. Every week will launch you into an alternate reality, so buckle up, it's story time.
Hey guys, this is Arjun Gupta from Sci-Fi as the Magician, and you are listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
full disclosure here, that interview with Zach was recorded back in September. I have pushed it a number of times, just waiting for a good time to use it when other interviews came along that were more time sensitive. And it just kept getting pushed and getting pushed and getting pushed. And then I realized, you know, they just announced that new project Zach was talking about. So this would be the perfect opportunity. So I'm going to instead push my best of 2019 selections to the first show of 2020. And I will let Zach talking about Eclipse in Port of Earth and Lost City Explorers, mostly Eclipse and a little bit of Port of Earth, and have that as the final show of 2019. There are announcements that came out right before Christmas, that week before Christmas, from Aftershock Comics announcing the new title he was talking about. It's called Join the Future, and it's a sci-fi western. He had me at western. I will admit, he had my attention at western. And it'll be out from Aftershock in March 2020. And I'm going to read a quote here from Zach about the series. It captures the classic spirit of the Western, gunslinging excitement and grandiose adventure, but with a sci-fi futuristic twist. As technologically advanced cities reign supreme in the dying whispers of the all-American small town. I'm excited because it's more than a story of the city versus the country. It's a story about the ever-changing landscape of America. So, like I said, he had my attention at Western, and I'm definitely going to send him an email and say, hey, can I get an advanced copy to read this? Because, yeah, Western. So that makes this the perfect, perfect time to finally publish this interview. Sorry it took 3 extra months, Zach. I really, no excuse, but timing seems almost sent by the universe. But anyway, like I said, next week, which will be the first weekend of 2020, going to do a retrospective of the things that impressed me or caught my attention or surprised me in 2019. We're going to go through television, books, movies. Yeah, a handful of comics will be in there too. And yes, some of these items were things that I talked about with their creators, be it movies, indie movies, comics. And I hope you find those interviews entertaining as well as the actual end product themselves. Hopefully, you'll check them out. Most of them, most of the indie movies, the indie sci-fi and the indie horror are available on digital somewhere. If I know where, I'll provide links to them all. That's going to be a rather massive list. The only other bit of news I have, let's see, January Manifest is coming back on NBC. Season 2 of that should hit the airwaves, I believe, January 6th. Is that right? Whatever that first Monday in January is, I believe, is when Manifest Season 2 returns. Somewhere in there, what else was I waiting for? I was waiting for an announcement on The Magicians, because Season 4 just hit Netflix. I have not had a chance to watch The Witcher yet. I am intrigued. I want to see that. Just haven't gotten to it yet. And of course, The Expanse also hit Amazon a couple weeks early. Go check that out. I still have to watch Lucifer season 4. I am so behind on that. Bonus news, just found out that Lucifer is also still on Hulu. So the first 3 seasons of Lucifer are still on Hulu, while all 4 seasons are on Netflix. And I think it was Mark Bernardin who pitched this idea after the CW's Crisis on Infinite Earths crossover happened. He wants to pitch a limited series, like 6 or 8 episode miniseries, featuring Tom Ellis as Lucifer and Matt Ryan as John Constantine as they drive cross country, raising hell and breaking hearts. And my first reaction was that Futurama gift, shut up and take my money. powers that be, if you're listening to Mark, let him make that miniseries, because Matt Ryan and Tom Ellis together as John Constantine and Lucifer exploring the United States from coast to coast as only they could would be delightful and sinful at the same time. Please, somebody make this happen. Give that man some money to make that series happen. That'll do it for this episode. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to call. The number is 602-635-6976, or shoot me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. We also have many ways for you to listen to Slice of Sci-Fi. We have Apple Podcasts, we have Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, Player FM, and I'm thinking about ways to get the show on Pandora and Spotify so even more people can check out the show as well. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher, please leave us a review. Let people know you're enjoying the show and maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. And yes, I will engage in conversations about random fun stuff relating to science fiction, horror, fantasy, action, adventure, the occasional mystery thriller as well, especially the random geeky sci-fi questions. You can check us out on YouTube. We're Slice of Sci-Fi there. And you can check us out on Facebook. We're also Slice of Sci-Fi over there. If you have not yet heard from me, check your email, check your spam filter. I think something is going on out there. There were enough entrants for all 6 copies of the Scary Stories documentary to find new homes. However, not all 6 winners who I contacted have reached back out to me to give me their mailing address. So if you haven't checked your email, or if you haven't checked your spam folder, dive into that for me, please, and reply. And of course, we have the website, sliceofscifi.com. Our next series of secret sauce contests will be starting up soon. Keep an eye out for that in the first week of January. I'd like to thank everyone who is supporting the show, helping support the show through Patreon. Patreon.com/sliceofscifi is the place to go. If you would like to join the crew that is helping keep this show and other shows online, your support does help keep the lights on for all of the Slice of Sci-Fi Universe projects, which include Writers After Dark, Babylon Podcast, Charlie Jade, and a few other shows. And if a monthly pledge through Patreon is not in your budget at the moment, an occasional donation every now and then can be made through the PayPal link, paypal.me/sci-fi-summer. All of your donations go to help keep this geeky effort online, and I do thank all of you from the bottom of my heart. Your support means so much to me. And again, thank you. And that'll do it for 2019. My word, where did this year go? Anyway, thank you all for listening. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next year. Take care.